We ended our time together last Sunday morning by noting the passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1 that if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. We note, first of all, that the title bishop is the same, referring to the same office as the title elder. You'll notice in verse 5 of Titus chapter 1, he said, "I left you in Crete," Paul talking to Titus, "that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I have commanded you." The word bishop, the word elder, the word shepherd, those different words indicate the same office. And it is a good thing to desire it. While we will not say a desire for the office is a qualification per se, an individual who does not have that desire certainly should not be serving. It has been stated, and I'm not sure I'm in full agreement with it, that everyone should desire to be an elder. And I won't dispute the fact that we should desire to help the church and to strengthen the church in what ways we are capable of helping. But there may be an indication or realization on the part of a man that he does not have the qualifications that are needed. Perhaps some limitations that he has, that he's not able to serve in that capacity. And so the desire may not be there with the realization of those things. But the desire does have to be present, or else you would have someone who is either serving for the wrong motivation or would be doing so in a grudging manner rather than freely. So we want to have that desire. Now, with that in mind, also in verse 5 of Titus chapter 1 is the statement that you should set in order the things that are lacking. I think that there is a broader context in which this is the case. We talked about the responsibility of the elder to exhort, to encourage, to admonish, all of those things, which would be in part equipping them in things that are lacking. So the preaching is a part of that. But I do think there is a special context in which that is used directly in verse 5, and that is that if a congregation does not have elders, there is something lacking in that congregation. That is not God's intent. It's not God's desire. And so a congregation who is lacking qualified men to serve as elders should be striving to reach that point, to qualify men to serve. And if men are qualified to serve, then a congregation ought to have them serving in that capacity. So it is something that is lacking if elders are not present in a congregation. God's plan is that they be there. So let's keep those things in mind before we get into the discussion of the qualifications themselves. Anybody have any questions or comments before we actually get into a discussion of each of these? All right, then let us start off with the qualification of blameless. Now, the word blameless that is found in verse 6, and let's go ahead and read verses 6 through 9 once again. If a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination, for a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able, by sound doctrine, both to exhort and to convict those who contradict. These are the qualifications that are listed, and as we read through those, it may be that you notice that several of those words that are used in Titus chapter 1 were also used in 1 Timothy chapter 3. In other words, the qualifications do overlap. In order for us to understand what the entire list of qualifications are, we have to compile them. So there are a few things that are mentioned here that are not mentioned in 1 Timothy chapter 3. But by and large, the list is very similar, indicating the same type of man that should be serving as one who is an elder. Now, the first thing I want to note is the word that is defined blameless in this particular text, or translated blameless in this text, is actually a different word than that which is used in 1 Timothy 3. Having said that, there is not much difference between the two terms. They are very close synonyms. In this particular passage, it is the Greek term anagletos. And you'll notice the definition, and we're taking the definitions from Thayer. That cannot be called into account, unreprovable, unaccused, and blameless. So when we're talking about this particular phrase, the idea is that a claim cannot justly be made that there is something amiss in the man. We made the distinction as we talked about that qualification in our study of 1 Timothy 3, that this does not mean that there is not criticism of the man. The question is the criticism just? If you were to say that the criticism cannot exist, then even our Lord would be an individual who would be unqualified as a result of that, because there were many false claims, false blame that was placed upon Jesus. In John chapter 8 and verse 46, Jesus asked the question, "Which of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me?" There were individuals who were seeking to call him a blasphemer, seeking to call himself unjustly God's son. And as such, they railed against him in this. But they could not convict him of sin in that because he was guiltless. The claims that he made concerning himself were true claims. And the accusations that were raised against him were false. And so he was blameless, even though there were individuals who were circulating false claims about him. So what we want to emphasize is that we need a man whose character is such to where if any false accusation or any accusation is raised, it can be demonstrated that that accusation is inappropriate and not true. It goes to a person's deportment, how he conducts himself in public and private, so that if that accusation is raised, it's not there's no merit to it. Reasonable people, as they examine the evidence with regard to the claim made, will recognize that there is no merit to it. What it is not equal to, the concept of blameless, is perfection, however, because we all do falter from time to time. The idea that an elder is one who is perfect, that does not sin, that's not true. But a man who has dealt with his sin, showed himself to be righteous by repenting of his sin and making it right, that man is one who is blameless. He is qualified because he is standing before God. He's done whatever is necessary to make things right on the occasion when he does wrong. And as such, no one can say, "This is the kind of person you are," and object to that. So that's the concept that we have with regard to the idea of blamelessness. Anybody want to add anything to that? Okay, we might go through these fairly quickly in our discussion this time, since we discussed these in some detail last time. The husband of one wife is the next qualification that is given. And the phrase we mentioned last time, because this is in both lists, is a one-woman man. That's the literal rendering of it. The word husband is the Greek word anir, and it means a man or a husband. One is the Greek word mia, rightly translated in gune, is a woman or a wife. So one woman man or a man with a husband with one wife is what's under consideration. What it obviously excludes is polygamy, having more than one wife. It also excludes adulterous marriages. If you are bound to one and married to another, that would be something that would be a matter of sin, and a person who is engaging in sinful activities by that matter would not be blameless, in addition to not being the husband of one wife, and would disqualify. The third thing is celibacy. And we wanted to emphasize that once again, that there are individuals who have the idea that that this does not exclude bachelors from serving as elders. And when we talked about the reason why, there seems to be some substance to the idea that having a wife and having children is something that allows an individual to prove himself capable in the realm of oversight. In other words, if he has the ability to rule over his own house well, that is an indication that he would be successful in ruling over a congregation or exercising authority in a congregation. And so one who is not married and has never been married is an individual who Though he may have those capabilities, we don't know that. He's unproven. And the Lord's church is not something that you want to take chances with. And so you want to make sure that the men have shown themselves capable in this regard. And that's why he is to be the husband of one wife. There may be something as well with regard to the wife enabling the man in some way to accomplish some of his work, to where there is a distinction that is made between the man who has a wife. Perhaps one that is most specifically mentioned is hospitality, and the one who does not have a wife. I'm not sure of the legitimacy of that. We discussed that in some detail last week. But the first point is certainly a strong one that is made, that a man who is not married has not shown himself capable. He may be capable, but he's not proved it. And that's what we want, is proven individuals. And so that's why this qualification is given in this place. Questions, comments about the husband of one wife? Yes?
Well, some of these requirements are, how can you say it, unchallengeable or something, because just like that, I mean, you either have it or you don't. And some of the people, I think, try to slide it by sometimes by saying, well, they have a wife or something like that. And these, they need to have one wife and they need to have believing children.
Yeah, that's something that we discussed in great detail in our discussion of 1 Timothy chapter 3 when we went over that. And, you know, the response that I would give to that is the fact that, as I mentioned last week in our discussion of these issues, we have to be long-suffering with one another as we study these things, because some have convictions about what that qualification entails. Everyone agrees that the qualification is necessary, but there may be some differences with regard to that. For example, one who is already serving and his wife dies, does that automatically disqualify him? And there are differences with regard to that. There are also differences with regard to the having of believing children. Does that mean a plurality, or can a single child be sufficient? Others who have a plurality of children and perhaps all of them are faithful but one, majority faithful, and what surrounds that, and does that automatically disqualify? And different brethren have different views of that. And so we have to, if there's an issue, and I think the problem or the time in which this comes into play especially is in a congregation where you're trying to appoint men. We're going through the studies, and men are raised who might have those specific things, and those discussions need to be held on those occasions. And we just need to be mindful of the fact that brethren have differed on these things forever, ever since they were established. And we have to be long-suffering and careful as we discuss them. But you're right. That's the husband of one wife is not a suggestion. It is a requirement with regard to that qualification. Anybody else with regard to that? Okay, the next one then is the having faithful children, which again is a little bit different from what we found in 1 Timothy chapter 3. The qualification is referencing the same thing. Verse 4 of 1 Timothy chapter 3 says, "One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission, with all reverence, for if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God?" It's a little bit more lengthy in the description. And the wording is a little bit different. Having his children in submission with all reverence, where here he has faithful children, not just submissive children, but the statement is faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Submissive and insubordination would be antonyms. A submissive child is not an insubordinate child. And so that's tied in with 1 Timothy chapter 3. But the difference, I think, is the word faithful in this particular text. We wanted to make note of that word. It's the one that we have defined up on the board, pistos. And that word faith or faithful is one that is, it has a number of connotations regarding it. Sometimes that word has reference to faith itself, belief. It has reference to, depending on the context, the faith, having reference to what it is, that objective thing that we believe. It has reference sometimes to faithfulness, that is, a constancy in our belief concerning any particular thing. And I think that's right in this particular context. So the definition would be by Thayer, trusty or faithful. And in the New Testament, it is often equated with that concept of faithfulness to God. There are differences that individuals have with regard to this faithful children as to whether the object of that faithfulness is the Father or whether it is God Himself. But the idea, I'll just make a point that Marshall Patton makes in his commentary on this particular subject. He makes note again of these domestic qualifications as indicative that a man has oversight in his family, that is, as it should be, and thus he is again showing himself capable in oversight in the congregation. And a child that is, let's say, not yet accountable. We have a man who has children who are young, and so they're not yet reached the age of accountability to where God would hold them accountable for sin in their life, and they would need to respond in faith to the gospel. That individual could not, that child could not prove that man to be capable of being qualified. But if a child has reached an age of accountability, and in response to the sin that is in his life, he has become obedient to the gospel and is living accordingly. He's living a life of righteousness. Well, that is something that proves or indicates that this man is ruling his house well. And so in that case, it would be again an indication that he could be trusted to serve in the capacity of oversight. So the context, it seems to me, would specifically have reference to those who are, in fact, faithful to God, someone who has obeyed the gospel and is living accordingly. That's the idea of the word pistos in this particular passage. Now you'll notice I didn't put the definition of the other two words up, but I do want to make note of them as well. The word dissipation is the Greek word asotia, and it means an abandoned, dissolute life, being prodigal. So I would want you to consider the prodigal son who he demanded of his father money and he used it to live a dissolute life. That's what a dissolution or dissipation has reference to. Insubordination is one who is not and cannot be subjected. He cannot be controlled. He's disobedient. He's unruly. And again, the idea would be in contrast to 1 Timothy chapter 3, an individual who is one who is submissive to his father. And so that ties in as well. So those are two things that would cause an individual to be considered not qualified to serve as an elder. If his children are asotia, they're abandoned, prodigal, dissolute in their life, given over to immorality, or they are insubordinate and disobedient to their father. Those two things would be disqualifying as well. So, questions, comments about that particular qualification? Yes, yes.
I read something studying for this that I never come across before, and I thought I would share it, not to muddy waters or anything, but it's just caused me to think, well, sometimes I read it, and I don't think it was Brother Patton that said it, but just to introduce the idea, one of the things we talked about is plurality. What does it mean? I'm very familiar with FAA federal orders. And in front of those orders, there's usually a list of words that are defined how they can be used in the order. Things like must, shall, and will. And one of the things that you often see is the plural includes the singular and the singular includes the plural. Well, this commentator that was writing this on this specific verse here was saying, therefore, we must come to the conclusion that when it comes to the faithful children, it only takes one of his children to be accused of dissipation or insubordination to make him unqualified. But it takes all his children to be faithful and be qualified.
Okay.
I thought that was very interesting.
That one will be disqualified.
If you never heard that before.
Well, not in those words, but that's a position that many take. Yeah, we discussed that in 1 Timothy chapter 3 with regard to it. So there's two ways of looking at that concept of plurality, is that some would say that you have to have a plurality of of children in order to be qualified, where some would say the singular is included in the plural in that regard. So that's one of the issues that arise. And then the second issue that arises is if you have a plurality of children, one is unfaithful or two are unfaithful and others are faithful, that would not necessarily disqualify. Again, having discussed those things, I appreciate the bringing that up. I just kind of didn't want to rehash it all over again, over and over again, since we discussed it.
I just thought it was interesting the way it was worded. I'd never actually seen it worded that way before. And I may have made this comment before, but I don't think the qualifications necessarily address the failures of the person that's under discussion here. I think there are some instances where what the Holy Spirit is trying to avoid is bring reproach upon the church or even question. Part of being blameless is that no blame can be brought against him, whether it's true or not. He may have four faithful children and one that was faithful and fell away, and that was that person's fault, not the father's fault. But in order to make sure that there's no question in the church or in the community, let it not be another. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Jerry.
I guess the thing that's a little bit puzzling to me is it seems like this list is a little different than the one he gave Timothy.
Yeah, well, it's not identical.
So why would they be different? They're both going out in several different places to qualify elders.
My only response would be to that is that we have both lists. We have both lists. And so as a result of that, for us to establish that pattern, we have to be faithful to both lists. As far as why there's some differences, there's some similarities, but there's some differences. In some of it, I hope I didn't turn that off. In some of it, it's just worded a little bit differently. It may be that, he's already discussed with Timothy and Titus these things, maybe in person. So what he doesn't raise in one list, he's already discussed, so he knows they know. It's all somewhat speculative. But while we wonder why the lists are different, they're not exactly right, the question is what do you do with that wondering? And I'm willing to say I don't know why they're different. I can posit a few things, but it's all speculative. But sometimes individuals will do that to try to get around the necessity of any particular thing, or use the fact that there are some differences there to indicate that there's no hard and fast set of qualifications that have to be present for a man to serve. And that's speculative, and that's dangerous to do that kind of thing. We know in 1 Timothy 3 a bishop must be, and then here in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, if a man is, are two phrases that indicate that if he's not, well, he must be. If he isn't, well, he should be. so that those are required. But as far as the why, I've wondered the same thing, and I trust that there's a reason behind it. I could speculate as to what that reason is, but that's all it would be speculation.
Yeah, I agree. To my human pea brain, it makes sense that a man should have faithful children. Of course, we start talking about three children, and only one has been the gospel. The other two aren't accountable yet. They start putting all these
a lot of scenarios
around. To me, the difference between the list of elders and deacons is the fact that the elders do have faithful children. That's really the big difference. That would be the big difference. Otherwise, they're pretty much the same.
Very, very similar. Very similar. Yeah, it's a which, with regard to that, it would be a further proving, and it would be also indicative of the age group of a man who is an elder, is that he's older, and the children have had an opportunity to grow up, and that's all relative, certainly. But there's a difference between elders and deacons, is that elders are older men in that regard. But
the only thing that comes to my mind is when they're in the home, they're under the rule of the father. When they're outside the home, they're adults and their responsibility is their own. I don't fully understand how the father could be held responsible for that. I think I know some elders that said, if they're not faithful, I don't feel like I should serve. But that's a personal thing. I just have this feeling that, you know, God doesn't hold us responsible for what someone else does.
Right. Well, and that's certainly the case. That doesn't touch the point that Dennis made, though, in that the concept of being blameless and how it might be perceived.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, you said, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but you said earlier, is it either is or isn't?
Yes.
And right. And that's the view that some people hold. So yeah. Let's say, as an adult child, someone becomes unfaithful and it has nothing to do with the family at all or the father at all. It's just a fall in with a bad crowd after they leave the home or whatever the case may be. Still says believing children. You know, so that's the view that some hold, is that's an absolute thing that you can't trifle with. And again, that's why I'm always, because I have my views, I expressed my views before in regard to this, but it's just important. A couple of things that are important. Number one, we'd be loving in our discussion of these things because they can cause division in church. Secondly, there are some churches which have made decisions that I would differ with regard to what a particular qualification meant. That doesn't mean that they were disregarding the qualifications. They just came to a conclusion like you did in this particular instance that maybe this is the case, and so they appoint men to serve. And I'm not going to say it's not my place to judge that congregation and say that's an unfaithful congregation because that man they put in is not, according to my view of it, not qualified. I could give you any number of examples in this area and other places of men who are serving who I do not think are qualified to serve, just because of my understanding of these qualifications. So, it's a problem. But what we need to do is to be mindful of that problem and to be careful as we're discussing these issues. Dennis and then Tommy.
I just want to touch on what Terry said a while ago. I hate to, because we already moved past it, but I think there's something that's good in it, and that's the idea that Paul wrote to Timothy. Had to abide by what Paul wrote to him. Paul wrote to Titus. Titus had to abide by what Paul wrote to him. It's none of our concern whether or not Timothy might have had a quick-tempered elder or not. And Titus couldn't. The fact is, like you said, we have both. Now we have to abide by both. So other than that, that's past.
And the other thing about this is that if you get a man who has all the qualifications in 1 Timothy 3, he's probably going to have all the qualifications in Titus 1 too, vice versa, because it's a type of person who's showing himself. So, again, I mean, that's a little bit of I don't want to be a cop-out or trying to brush it aside, but I do think that when you have a man who is conscientious and is driven to qualify himself in accord with 1 Timothy chapter 3, then you're not going to find anything in Titus 1 typically that would disqualify him, and vice versa.
Well, let me touch on that real quick, because I think the idea of being blameless covers a lot of things. Timothy wasn't about to put in an elder that wasn't holy, even though being holy wasn't an actual requirement in his list. So there's some things that's kind of obvious. And I dare say there may be some other things that are not in either of these lists. But if we saw a man was guilty of, we couldn't put him in either.
Right. Yeah. Well, he has to be in good standing with God. An individual who is failing in the Christian life is not a person we could or should put in as an elder. Tommy, do you have something?
Well, any time that, if I ask you a question when you were 30 and I ask you a question again when you're 40, you may explain that in a little bit different terminology. So I'm not troubled by the fact that the lists are different. I also realize that it's not a checklist. Like you have said, it's trying to describe what a certain person does. And so with either of those lists, you can determine a faithful elder. And with both of those, you may have a more comprehensive list than you would have before. But since they're not a checklist, it's describing characteristics and qualities of a person. I don't think there's a very... The description doesn't bother me at all.
No, I appreciate that. I don't think it bothered Jerry either. He's just curious.
Hey, yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, Dick. Dick.
You remember discussion about faith in children. It comes up about Eli, and he had a growing trembling. He was married, and he was and he was charged with not disciplining them. How far and why from the apple fall from the tree, you might say. You know, we know it's under the roof in the house, until the household, but when they go out on their own, a couple of weeks they're unfaithful, then you kind of wonder about that. Or even with Eli, I mean, it was.
Well, that's what comes into it. We've had, you know, two points that have been made. Some would say that this idea of qualification you're having, if you got someone who after they leave the house becomes unfaithful, that would be irrelevant for a number of reasons. Dennis brought up one with regard to the concept of blameless and how it can be perceived in the community. Then someone who takes the other view, they would bring that into consideration with regard to why it is that they have become unfaithful. If it is because of a lack on the father's part, that certainly would be disqualifying, even if the person is making their own decisions at that point in time. So, again, you have to get to the point as to what you think of that qualification, what that qualification means, before you judge things on a case-by-case basis. Because someone might say, well, because it means this, it doesn't matter what the reason for the unfaithfulness is of this adult child, because it says having faithful children. Or if someone says that it's a judgment on the, and specifically and exclusively a judgment on the father's training of the child, then they can say, well, that doesn't apply in this particular case because it's obvious he was a good father. Look at his other kids. Or it happened, and we know the reason why it happened, because of the unfaithfulness. So the father's not to blame in that. So that doesn't disqualify him. That's the two views, or the two applications. But it comes down to what you think the qualification means and how should it be applied. And then you take about it on a case-by-case basis in that regard. Again, that's why there are differences and why different congregations handle it differently. Because it's a difficult thing. Yes, Jerry.
I'm not moving on.
That's fine. That's fine.
But I've known men who met all these qualifications. If you put their name in front of the group, people will say, no way. They had one man up, had no people skills. He admitted he had no people skills. Even though he may have sort of met these specifics, overall, it was obvious he would not be a good elder. He's trying to help us try to identify, I think what Tom said, he's trying to help us find the kind of man we need to have as an elder.
So. All right. Missed it.
You know, along that line, just throwing out the side, and we don't have elders here now, but what we will, but Jerry brought out that then put a man up that is not qualified, so we've got to be careful about that. That you put somebody that's not qualified, and then when you go talk to them, you find out they're not qualified, and they'll get accepted. I've no case of when they left the church, even left their wife. I mean, it messed up their whole faith, you know. So we got to be careful on that. We can discuss that another time.
Yeah.
But
it's very important.
Think about it.
These are not suggestions, they are requirements, and we need to keep that in mind.
They don't put somebody up there because they're your friend, you know, and they're here every day faithful, but they just don't use all the qualifications, and they don't know that.
The thing that seems to come up so often is is men are put up in certain circumstances who are good businessmen. And that's the reason, you know, obviously successful businessman, or he's a manager of people, and so putting him in the church, and that's not one of the qualifications. Okay, let's go on to the next, because an interesting thing, the word blameless is used a second time in this list. It was used at the very beginning of it, there in Titus 1 and verse 6, if a man is blameless. And now again, in verse 7, a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God. So the key here, as you distinguish between the two, because it's the same word that is used again, is that he is to be blameless in a particular area. This comes up now. You'll notice that it comes immediately following the domestic qualifications. And so, again, maybe this is an indication as to why the domestic qualifications of having one wife and having faithful children is given. Because it's important that a man be blameless in the area of stewardship. And perhaps the most important stewardship that we are given outside of the Lord's body is the stewardship that we are given as men over our home. God will hold us accountable. We are not to provoke our children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. So this idea of stewardship is something that is extremely important in the area of domestic qualifications, and it is also something that is going to be required of the bishop in regard to his work as a bishop or as an elder. If he is not doing it as he is supposed to do it, then that's not faithfulness in his stewardship. You want a man who is doing it as God said to do it with regard to the home, because it's going to be important that he does it as God says to do it in the church. And that's why those previous qualifications are given. So, the idea of stewardship is the definition that I put up on the board there, the oikonomos. And that is the manager of a household or of household affairs. So, when we're talking about the idea of trustworthiness with regard to fulfilling the duties that you have in the home, there is that concept of faithfulness and stewardship. When it comes to the responsibilities that you have and the trustworthiness that is shown in the church, then the idea is he must be blameless. Now this, when we think about it that way, this is not so much a qualification with regard to blameless as a steward in the sense of let me rephrase this. It's showing yourself as being blameless with regard to the responsibilities that God has given you already. Because God is going to hold you responsible for the work that he gives you to do in the future. And so it is not and should not be construed as specifically or only limited to the domestic qualifications. But I do think that's where the emphasis was lying in the previous verse. Because if a man has another stewardship, another responsibility that he's not faithful in, then that would be something that could disqualify as well. But the most obvious one would be, you've got a home, you've got a wife, you've got a children, how are you acting? Are you doing things in accord with God's commands and God's requirements? Have you shown yourself faithful in that? If that is the case, then you would be blameless as a steward. And that's something he requires in the church as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verses 1 through 4. The apostle refers to stewardship with regard to his work and the preaching of the gospel. He says, "Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God." God gave him the responsibility to take the gospel of Christ to the Gentiles. And of course he did to the Jews as well. He said, "It's required in stewards that one be found faithful. But with me it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or a human court. In fact, I don't even judge myself, for I know nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord." So we have to be faithful to the Lord. The Lord is the one that we answer to, not men in this regard. And so that's what needs to be determined with regard to the stewardship, the responsibilities that God has given this man. Does God consider this man to be blameless, to be without fault? To we cannot convict him of wrongdoing in the way he's acted in this regard or not, because he must be blameless as a steward. So, an interesting thing, an interesting repetition here, but more specific in its application of the concept of stewardship. Questions, comments about that qualification? Okay, next four that are given are knots. These are things that should not be present. They should not be self-willed, should not be quick-tempered, should not be given to wine, should not be violent, should not be greedy for money. There's actually five there. So we'll talk about those. A couple of those, or several of those, are actually restated in 1 Timothy chapter 3. And then you'll notice some positive qualifications, character qualifications to end the study. That is to be hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, and self-controlled. So now we've gotten through the domestic qualifications a little bit, and we're going to look at some of the character qualifications in our study next week. And again, we'll take it as fast or slow as we need to get a good understanding of these things. Anybody have any final questions or comments before we dismiss the class today? Didn't really want to get into those.
We've got a couple of minutes, haven't we?
Just a minute.
This has nothing to do with this, but I've been thinking over the time when Paul wrote all these churches, like Colossae and Philippians and that, and he'd always have something good to say about their faith and all that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had somebody in the brotherhood that could do that with churches, you know, and say, well, you know, how we are here at Westside and other congregations like that, and we don't have, they usually have what are called brotherhood preachers, you know, like Robert Turner and Roy Hogdill and many others, Connie Adams and that. We still have brotherhood preachers, but they're not considered that way anymore, you know. I mean, as far as that goes, I mean, I would consider you to be a brotherhood a preacher, you know. But when this thing got in, you know, that you're a watchdog, you know what I mean by that. You've been accused of that, and that's not flattery, you know. But think about that. It's too bad there's not somebody that you, of course, have Paul the apostle there, but to make it to, what I just said. You know.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, again, you know, I have no problems with the idea of having men that are well respected throughout the brotherhood and hold a lot of meetings and those kinds of things. Of course, the idea of any man being in a position similar to the Apostle Paul, you have to be careful because Paul was an apostle, and you know that. Yeah, and there's a big difference in there. And the second thing is, I think with regard to that, there's just an indication in every single generation there is a period of peace and a period of fracturing. And it doesn't have to be, so I don't want to say that way in every single generation, but it seems to be so typical is that you'll have a big fight that will be over some doctrinal issue, and there will be a remnant that remains faithful, and there will be time that is spent where that remnant seems to be in full fellowship and in full agreement, and then all of a sudden another issue arises, and then there is a fracturing, and then there's... And I think that what happened in the 1950s is that there was a fracturing, and then there's a remnant that stayed faithful. Everybody's getting along for a while, and then some other issues come up. And it seems to me that the major issue that's caused problems among brethren in my generation is the issue of the bounds of Christian fellowship that came as a result of the teaching that was done on marriage before free marriage and other things as to who can we fellowship, who we can't. And all of that came up as a result of it. And as a result of that, there's a fracturing that's present, a de facto set of differences that have led to a lessening of influences of any particular individual and universal acceptance of men, I think is the way it is. And that's a shame, but that does happen quite often. And the fact that it happens is why it's so important to contend earnestly for the faith once for all delivered. You get through that period of time, and there's a faithful remnant, and we rebuild and go on. And that's what we have to do. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. We'll pick up with those knots beginning in the next verse. Not self-will will be the first one in verse 7. Okay? Thank y'all.